Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Thursday, March 7th, 2024. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the two words that say start here in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of the book contains a narrative description and explanation of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 19 years now to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And if you do that before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. It contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process. And it contains a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. You can also download from that same page a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one that contain the audio of when people have called into the internet show and asked to be stepped through the worksheet process. So if you choose to listen to those, they can serve as a tutorial for you to how to get the best benefit from these tools in the shortest time possible. And we hope people do all of that soon and often, primarily because it tends to improve the quality of people's lives the more they do that. And secondarily, because it tends to prompt comments, questions, answers, and testimonials. If you have any of those to share with us, we'd appreciate you doing so by giving us a call at 563-999-3581. Once you do that, press 1 on your phone. Alternatively, you can send us an email. You can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, or you can email Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org. That's whyagain.org. And if we get a comment or a question from you through an email, we will address it on the internet show. And then as time allows, send you a notification about what day and time that occurred so you can listen back to the archives for your feedback or input. greatly appreciate whenever anybody does that, because it makes it so much easier for us to live into our intention with this work. The intention we have with this work is to be of service. And that's just a whole heck of a lot easier to do when we know how things are landing for you. So if you're so inclined, please do let us know how things are working for you, what is of most benefit in the work we're doing, and or if you have any questions that we can answer that allow you to get more effective use of the tools. That's assuming that you might be using them in your life. One of my little notes says to remember to let people know we have a support group that's happening tonight. It's absolutely free. Tuesdays and Thursday nights, most Tuesdays and Thursdays, we do a support group that people can join through Zoom for free. And all the information you would need to join us there is available on the MindShiftersAcademy.org website. The groups run from 6:30 to 9 p.m. Central Time. And we'd be very happy to have you join us, and or for you to send the information along to somebody else that you know that you think might benefit from getting access to this supporting, respectful group of people who get together on a regular basis to learn more about these tools and use them and do worksheets and or discuss how the application of various tools can be of benefit. On Tuesday, we were listening to a darshan with JM, who's the gentleman who channeled the Way of Mastery. And a darshan is simply a teaching session where he just sits and starts talking about one of the many aspects of the Way of Mastery as a book, or he's working his way through the lessons in most of the darshans. And he had the same observation I did. It was in Lesson 9, and it isn't labeled as an exercise, but there's a recommendation that we do this practice on a regular basis. And we're invited to the awareness that working with these suggestions is, you know, like a step-by-step how-to to improve the quality of your life experience. So I don't know that everybody who's listening would know, but the darshans, the Way of Mastery as an offering was channeled from 1994 to 1997. And then about 4 or 5 years later in 2011, or 15 years later in 2011, John Mark Hammer, the man who channeled the work, decided to do a series of presentations, a deep dive, if you will, basically the same kind of thing that we're doing now. And he did it from his ashram, or an ashram in Bali, and made it available to people that were on his mailing list to pay a reasonable fee and get access to those, I think they were weekly online sessions. And it's video and audio. And at the time, I had been actively involved in reading, and I put my name on mailing lists for the Way of Mastery and Way of Mastery support groups, and I happened to get knowledge of it, and so I signed up for it. And so I have most of those files available on my computer to share with the support group and to make available to others on a limited basis when they request it. And it's just, it's about 3 years of material. We did 75 hours of darshans just on the first 12 lessons. And we were doing that in the support group. And I didn't think anybody would be that into it, but the support group was thrilled, and they wanted to do it all and do more. So that's what we did at one point when we were still meeting in person. And it is a fascinating process to my eye and ear to go very slowly with a book like this, just like it is for Christian Sundberg's book, and that book is titled A Walk in the Physical, or a book like A Course in Love, or a book like My Big Toe, My Big Theory of Everything, or Christian Sundberg's book, to go slowly through it and actually, if what's there isn't presented as an exercise, turn it into an exercise. How might I do something differently in my life day to day based on what I just read? I just had a third session with a new patient, and and the essence of it was, he happens to be a mechanic. And so I was starting to talk to him about the fundamental changes he was going to have to start making within himself if the patterns in his life, his marriage and his relationships was going to get any better. Because he's coming in because he gets angry and irritated about things, and his relationships are all in disarray. And so I started talking to him about the fundamental changes he's going to have to start making within himself. And as soon as I stopped to take a breath, he said, okay, but here's what happened the other day. And he wants to talk about a disruption that happened in one of his relationships. And I listened. And I knew as he was starting that there wasn't going to be anything I could tell him about this, because except for choosing to respond differently from within himself, he doesn't have any control over what the other person does. And so I started to try and go back to the core issue that I was trying to lay out for him that his therapy would need to be about. And he started going back, but what about this other situation? So I said to him, well, now, you're a mechanic. If somebody came to you and they said, my truck is making this really weird set of noises, as a mechanic, is there any part of you that would just tell that person, well, turn the radio up louder so you won't have to hear the noise, or put on these noise-canceling headphones, and that'll take care of the problem? And he laughed, thankfully. I can't, Dr. Michael Rice talks about this when he talks about working at the level of cause, C-A-U-S-E, versus working at the level of effect. And most of our medical profession these days is working at a level of effect. They're working at symptoms and symptom alleviation or cover-up or relief from symptoms, but they're not, most of the time, they're not working on what would be a cause level remedy. They're not actually changing anything at the level where the upset or the problem is. They're simply saying, well, there is this problem. And it's making, and let's say it's in the truck, and it's making this noise, so let's just get rid of the noise. But let's not go in the truck and look at what's making the noise and why it's making that noise. So that's what we try and do with people in these tools. We say, look, in the way of mastery, it says from the very, very third lesson, it says, you as a human being have been trained to think that what your perception is the truth of life. And it's not. It's a distortion. It's arising from the trivialities that have been shoved into you by your families, by the language you've learned, by the cross-generational traumas in your families. And it isn't useful to live your life believing that your perceptions are accurate. So whatever you can do to wake up to any negative feeling you have when a perception arises within you and choose to dismantle it, choose to cancel it, ask to be shown again rather than continue your existing pattern of believing that your perceptions are valid, even though they leave you feeling sad, hurt, scared, upset, traumatized. Begin at the beginning. Begin at the cause level. It says in the first lesson on the fifth page, you don't experience anything that isn't the effect of the choices you've made. And there is almost no one I've ever met who understands that and actually been taught that and works to apply that wisdom in their life. Almost no one I've ever met. So there's the wisdom. How do I apply it? The wisdom is that everything that I experience in the form of a thought and an emotion is available for me to make a change within the process that gave rise to that emotion. But if I believe my emotions are caused by someone or something outside of me, if I believe I know what the problem is and I'm still upset, then I'm doomed to suffer with that problem until something on the outside or from the outside world shifts or changes. That's what we're called to in this work, to wake up to the idea, the awareness, the direct observation that we only experience upset, fear, sadness, anger, grief, confusion, hurt, thoughts of low self-esteem, thoughts of a situation being helpless or hopeless. We only experience that because we are creating it. So again, our call-in number is 563-999-3581. If you call that number and press 1, we can have a conversation. What is on your mind today, especially if you're on the call and you haven't raised your hand in a while? We'd be happy to hear from you. If I start reading again, even if I'm in the middle of reading, interruptions are welcome. The entire purpose of our being here is to teach what we most need to learn and practice in our lives and to help others get introduced to and build solid skills using the tools that are offered. I remember I had a session with someone last night who was questioning the validity of repeating the same instructions to use the reality management worksheet, or to identify the goal in my mind whenever I'm upset, and then simply and directly say, I cancel this goal. And just watch what happens. Don't do it in order to try and cause a different result. Do it just to quit causing the same undesirable result that you're experiencing in the moment. Right. It's the idea that Rilke talks about of learning to live in the question, I don't know what's going to happen when I cancel a goal. And if I have an idea in mind that I think this is going to happen when I cancel a goal, it's probably going to sabotage the best effects that I could get if I just get out of my head, get out of the conscious logical mind, and step into the use of the tool. The use of the tool, what is it at that level? It's just saying, with practiced effort, I cancel my need to be right. I cancel my need for anyone or anything to change, including myself. I specifically cancel the goal that's arisen in me that I'm aware of when I register this upset right now. And I ask to be shown the hidden part of my own mind that's actually creating this upset. And I do that without wanting something else to take its place. I do that just out of this curiosity to see what will take its place. What does life have to offer me when I quit trying to demand what I think I need and want? What kind of magic can happen when I understand that I'm not the maker and the doer? I'm just a conduit for the energy that can make and do all things. This is the part of the process that gets lost on a lot of people, because people say, well, I need an apartment and I need more money and I need this and I need that. How can I make it happen? And then they go out and they follow teachers that talk to them about how to manifest this, that, and the other thing. And they have a certain, there's all kinds of people have had a certain level of success with that. I'm just trying to make the clear point that that's not what this work is about. This work is about completely rearranging your belief system and letting go of your belief system and just asking to be shown how might life unfold differently, how might it be even better than I could ever have imagined, and watch what happens. Stay in the flow. Stay in the direct observation. I will, I'll be working to make available that story that I told yesterday. I'm not sure how accurately I told it yesterday, but there's a recording of it that is only, I don't know, maybe 6 minutes long. And I'll get that uploaded so that we can replay that. Yeah, it's about nine or ten minutes long. And again, it's the idea of the benefits we can accrue, we can experience when we learn to live more and more from direct observation. And we come into the way of mastery, and it says right in the third lesson, you're everything about your perception and your judgment creates problems for you. And that if you understood what happens when you judge, how even the very cells of your body cease to work properly, you'd never judge again. It gives a definition for the process of forgiveness. It says, to forgive means to choose to release another from the perceptions you have been projecting upon them. So in this work, it's every judgment and every perception is in error, because even my best guess at perception is a knockoff. It's a series of thoughts about a series of symbols. So it's two or three or four times removed from the actuality of life. And it's not that every perception I have is so damaging. It's just that every perception I have is a cheap copy, which is why so many yogis and meditation teachers spend so much time in their meditation, because one way to think about what they're doing in meditation is they're seeing through their perceptions. They're spending time, even if they're not consciously saying the words, I ask to be shown, they're spending time trying to find a different way to experience their life than through the conscious, logical, and all the language and all the judgment and all the decisions about what's right and wrong and good and bad. In Lesson 3, the Way of Mastery tells us that the opposite of forgiveness is judgment. And judgment, at any level, I judge this as good, I judge this as bad, at any level, judgment causes separation and guilt. And it'll, you know, if I'm judging someone, it says I've already judged myself. I mean, there are ways in which the 10 bottom line observations have been deeply informed by the Way of Mastery. And one of the bottom line observations says, I will never be upset about anything anybody else ever says or does or doesn't do that I think they should, unless I'm still judging myself negatively for doing the same or similar things. And most people, when I present that to them, they think that's an absolutely absurd thing, because they're upset that Putin has bombed the Ukraine, or they're upset that Netanyahu is sending troops into the Gaza Strip. They're upset that babies are starving, and they say, I've never made babies starve, and I've never bombed a country. But the Way of Mastery says, look, if you're truly honest, you'll be able to say that maybe 100 times in the last year, murderous thoughts have come to your mind. You may not have acted on it, may not have stayed more than a moment, but you've had the thought. You've had the energy move through your system. If you want to look that up in the book, it's in the third lesson under the section titled Forgiveness, is the bridge to the soul of your brother and sister. And then it says, there is nothing you can be aware of in the energy of another that you have not known in yourself. There is nothing that another person can say or do or even imagine themselves capable of saying or doing that you have not also known. Again, that simple childhood phrase, it takes one to know one. There's deep truth in that. There's wisdom in that. When you perceive another who is acting out of hostility and fear, the only way you can recognize it is because you have been there. The very fact that in your world, one can murder another's body and you can react with the knowledge that it is inappropriate, is because as a soul, you know the energies involved in the attempt to murder another. If you're honest with yourself, you can probably come up with at least 50 times in the last year that murderous thoughts have entered your mind. You may not act on them. You may not even dwell on them for more than a split second. And yet the energy has come into the field of your awareness, and you have known it, and you have recognized it. And the question then is, so who then is less than you? Who then is worthy of your judgment? The answer is no one. Who then is equal to you? Everyone. And who then is worthy of you extending love to them? Everyone. Forgiveness then, and forgiveness meaning the dismantling of all of your judgments and all of your perceptions. That is the link that links you to the soul or the essence of your brother and sister. Dismantling your judgments and perception is the bridge that, when cultivated, will allow you to see clearly. Not see the veils, but see the shimmering radiance of the creative energy behind the veils. You'll see not just the energies that another person is expressing, but you will literally be able to see what the events were in their life that seemed to cultivate their belief that they must act in a certain way to survive. And you will see what perceptions led them to feel justified in their inappropriate behaviors. And you will see it as clearly as though someone had drawn a picture in front of you. And then, because you're there in the moment living from direct observation, you will see skillfully just what to say and do to be a catalyst for the correction of their misperceptions. And if they're willing, they'll step into the correction. They will dismantle their judgments and perceptions, and they'll see the truth of their unity with all of creation, that they are connected to their source, just as you are. And when the hour comes, rest assured, you will walk in the world, and yet you will not be of it. Judgment, perception, projection, it's all an instantaneous thing when we are living from thought, when we're living from the past, when we're living from belief. And projection is the effect of the denial of the first axiom. What's the first axiom? Nothing you experience is caused by anything outside of you. The moment you forget that you are the creator of your experience, projection happens automatically. And you begin to believe that you're just a victim. And you begin to believe that you are being buffeted around in life like a dried up leaf on the wind. And this work requires vigilance and discipline. Not vigilance about what other people are doing, vigilance about my own thoughts. Oh, I see that I'm judging someone. Wow, I'm really good at that. I've done that a lot. I was taught how to judge for the very first time I got language. It's amazing that I'm living in a family and within a culture, within a world that teaches this whole process of judgment and perception. That's fascinating. I wonder, because it doesn't feel so good. I'm feeling kind of tight and tense. I wonder if I could choose something else. Never mind the content of the present moment. Never mind what my mind is telling me about the present moment. Let me get very clear about what I'm doing with my mind energy to create this experience of upset. Yeah, but, and then my mind shows me, they just broke into your house and stole your stereo. You spent a lot of money on that. You worked for years to save the money for that stereo. And as long as I stay focused on those, the details, what I call the content, and what my mind is showing me, and all the trivialities that my culture has programmed me to believe are true, I keep generating the negative emotion that I say I don't want. So literally, we're being invited to what our culture would call an insane practice, even if somebody's just broken into my house and stolen something that I've worked really hard for, and I'm invited to see them through the eyes of love. I'm invited to look on them with compassion rather than reactivity. I'm invited to wake up to the in that very real moment, the tightness, the upset, the tension I'm feeling, and understand that it's not being caused because they stole something from my house. It's being caused because of the interpretation I'm choosing and pouring my mind energy into about that outside event. This is something we hit on Tuesday in the group. Somebody asked, can we go back and watch a darshan about Lesson 9? And the title of Lesson 9 is All Events Are Neutral. And most people would say, well, that's just crazy. How could you just not get upset if somebody broke into your house and stole your possessions? Well, the how I could not get upset is I could choose a different interpretation on it, of it. Oh, I guess they must have needed those things more than I did. Oh, I wonder how this is going to turn into a blessing in my life. I wonder how, as I'm dealing with the insurance people and, you know, working to get the windows repaired that they broke out to get in or whatever, that I might meet people that will be a blessing in my life or that I might be a blessing in theirs. If I choose those thoughts, I don't generate anywhere near as much upset. That's the actual how. But what most people ask when they say, well, how could you think that? What they're saying is not how. They don't really want to know how to do it. They want to hold to their belief that the outside event is causing the upset. And then sometimes they jump from that to, oh, well, then I should just let anything happen, and I don't care, and nothing really matters, and I should break into somebody else's house and steal their stuff because it's okay for these other people to steal my stuff, and it's okay for me to steal somebody else's. Well, the way of mastery understands at very deep levels, whoever, whatever, whatever consciousness was giving rise to this has thought through this. And right here in Lesson 9 it says, all right, so now if we're going to look at this as all events are neutral, does that mean that a person should become cold-hearted, unconscious, and blind to their actions? And the answer is, of course not. Because part of awakening means to realize one's interconnection with the web of all relationships. It means awakening a reverence for the mystery that is capital L life. And it also means to release judgment of another who would view the world differently than you would. So if somebody breaks into my house and steals my possessions, I have the option. I can look at them as horrible and villainous and deserving of deep punishment, and or I could look at them as another being of brilliance and light who has either temporarily forgotten or yet to discover their brilliance. Recently, I watched the movie Mr. Church And I had quite a few tears coming up as I was watching that, resonating all kinds of, you know, good memories, fond memories, lost memories from my life. And but in the movie, essentially, the main character is somebody who is acting very, very lovingly and respectfully to other people. And only when he gets drunk does he give any sign that he was horribly abused by his father, beaten, verbally abused and beaten by his father. For the most part, that person in the movie, and there are people like this that I've had in my caseload for almost 50 years now, who have had very abusive circumstances in their life, and some of those people turn abusive. And they usually, the only way they end up in my office is if the court has mandated them. But other people who've been through some horribly abusive situations in their life have chosen to be the opposite of the behavior that was done to them. They've chosen to be people who go out to extend the good, the holy, and the beautiful. And what I'm telling you is the only way I can make any sense of that is what this the Way of Mastery is calling us to in Lesson 3 and Lesson 9, is the recognition that regardless of what's happening, all events are neutral until I decide here's the interpretation and I pour my mind energy into that interpretation and I create that experience for myself. And if I can wake up and realize that, yeah, I might have had some really difficult times growing up, and yet, in the next moment, I don't need to let my thoughts and beliefs about that drive my behavior. I can choose to cancel the goals, drop the beliefs, withdraw my attachment from the identification with those beliefs, and ask to be shown something else. So when people want to argue, what do you mean all events are neutral? There would be chaos. No one would ever do anything. No, no. In Lesson 3, it says, look, if somebody breaks into your house and steals something that you love, you are free in that moment to judge them, yes, but you're also free to see them in this, what the world would call an insane way of looking upon that person as one who's done that act as just a brother or sister who's crying out for help and healing. What if you chose to look upon them as one who does not know how to live in the world without being of the world? What if you chose to view them as someone who does not know the way to dismantle their own judgments and their own perceptions? They don't know the truth of the light, capital L light, that lives within them. And what if you just look at them as somebody who doesn't yet recognize their great power to create whatever they want and need in a way that isn't hurtful to anyone else? What if you chose to look upon them with compassion rather than creativity? And I'm just here to tell you that every time I do that, it dramatically changes my experience of life. And I'm talking about everything from little things like people tailgating me when I'm trying to drive home to somebody who ran into my car and totaled it just about 4 years ago now, maybe three. It's when I use these tools actively in my life, it dramatically improves the quality of my life. And that's what we're inviting people to. No matter how bizarre it might sound, to approach life as though all events are neutral, there's a deep gold mine of benefit that can come from choosing to observe life in this way and choosing to respond to it with compassion rather than reactivity and judgment. And to do it, it's going to take some work because I've got a whole boatload of things that have been programmed into me, and I've been taught to believe this, that, and the other thing for decades, even before I learned, like one heading in Lesson 9 says, learn to look with innocence on what you value. Learn to really take a look at what you have said is neutral and what's not neutral. What you're judging as important and not important. And then you open yourself to understanding how you have created your experience of life in your judgments and in your perceptions. And once you're tapped into that process of the way that you're creating, now you're free to create differently. And it's in Lesson 9 where it gives the story of the farmer that insisted on holding every single seed until she felt the perfect vibration from this seed before she would choose to plant it. Now, the corollary here is I'm being invited to watch the thoughts that I plant. Not every thought that runs through my mind. I'm not being invited to chase down every errant thought. I'm invited to get very clear about which thoughts I'm going to pour a lot of mind energy into. I'm going to value. I'm going to declare these are right or these are true for me. And if I choose to be vigilant and committed to changing what I value and what I pour my mind energy into, now I've opened the space for me to be looking at what it is that actually creates my experience of life. Now I'm looking at the cause level, C-A-U-S-E. I'm not just chasing down negative effects. And I'm just here to tell you from my own personal experience that it makes a there aren't really any words for how much better my life has gotten the more I have practiced the use of these tools and practice being vigilant about what I'm pouring my mind energy into, what I'm choosing to believe, what I'm choosing to declare has value for me. So we've got about 10 minutes left. 563-999-3581. Comments, questions, answers, testimonials. Call that number, press 1, and let us know how this is landing for you. I'm doing kind of an overview review because as I was finishing reading from Lesson 14, I heard myself read, again, another invitation to review Lesson 14 multiple times before moving on. And I was called to just, instead of just rereading Lesson 14, to try and talk about some of the primary observations in this work. So that's what I've been doing so far in this past hour. And I'd be happy to hear from anybody how that's landing for you and whether or not it makes sense to your mind or you've been able to wrap your mind around how all events are neutral. I think we talked about it. We had a person in our Tuesday group that was having a very hard time with this. And it's understandable because she's had some very intense life experiences recently that don't seem anything like neutral to her. Area code 314. Could this be the long-lost Doug?
Yes, it is. It could be.
Well, hello,
good
Doug.
Good morning. Hi. Hi. I decided to follow your encouragement and give a call. I was thinking about this very thing this morning exactly when I woke up. Like, you know, there are several things that have been disturbing me. And I think, I want
several things
peace.
What? Several things you've chosen to generate disturbance over, is that it?
Thank you. Yep, that's right. That's exactly right. And I'm like, how can I stop doing this? You know, it's like and then as you started into this, I was like, my mind is doing its usual, you know. Yeah, but excuse me. Yeah, but this is a problem, and you know, all the stuff that you say. And then I'm thinking, well, because you want to fight it, you want to do something about it, you think something should change, you know. And
who does?
The thought that I had here was just that the only way that I can possibly have a chance at knowing what right action would be is to first be at peace and about it. You know, it doesn't mean I have to approve of it or think it's a good idea or not take any action, but for my mind to be at peace. Because my goal on waking up is like, I want to be in a constant state of joy, love, peace, you know, and bliss, and not have my mind constantly take all these matters that come up and turn them into a disturbance. So I appreciate the review, you know. It's an ongoing process. I don't know what else to say.
Okay. So just stop right there, because if somebody's listening to this and they're new, they're going to think, oh, you know, Dr. Tim is picking on Doug and he's cutting him off and not letting him say what he really feels. And instead, what was happening there when I suggested a different way to speak about what you're experiencing,
yep,
what's happening there is a literal first step tool. If I keep saying there are several things upsetting me, I'm using my regulatory speech to program my mind to believe that these outside events are not neutral and they are causing my upset. And so it isn't nitpicking, and it isn't, you know, trying to say, oh, I know better than you. It's just suggesting, here's a tool, a first step tool you might choose to engage to help you get the results you say you want. And that is, use regulatory speech. Use your own thoughts and your speech about your thoughts to begin to reprogram the parts of your mind that have been conditioned to falsely believe that they are being made to feel certain things, that outside events are causing your upset. It's not the end all and be all. It is a wonderful first step. And if I truly want peace, you know, you were talking about you want this peace, you want this calm, you want this bliss state. One of the deep spiritual teachings across continents, across eons, it's the same, you know, we would call it perennial wisdom or perennial philosophy, is that when you engage on a spiritual journey, you set out completely unaware that when you reach the goal, you're going to realize you didn't travel anywhere.
Dr. Tim, I am going to have to, I'm loving what you're saying, but I absolutely have to take a call that's coming in.
Go right ahead.
I'll just
keep talking and
tomorrow.
You can listen later. So the idea is, if I can't recognize that the tool I'm using is always going to produce a result like the tool, then I'm going to think, oh, I can rage and I can blame and I can stomp around and play victim and still get to that loving, peaceful state. It can't happen. If I want that loving, peaceful state, I have to find a way to be in it now. And that's what we're talking about, understanding how the only reason I'm not in that loving, peaceful state in this moment is because of the thoughts, you might call them beliefs, the energies that I have identified with in this moment that I keep trying to claim are true. That's the only thing that's disturbing my peace, not the outside events, not the people and things around me that aren't, you know, doing what I think they should do. That's not causing my upset. The only thing that's causing my upset about those things is my thoughts about them. And there's the beginning and the end. It's all right there. I need to undo the patterns of beliefs and the identifications in my own mind that are keeping me believing that my upset is caused by anyone or anything outside of me. And if I can't do that, I can't make that progress that I say I want to make. Area code 541.
Hello, Celinda here. Very
welcome.
Quick. I just wanted to share my experience about regulatory speech. I got into two situations. One was quite a while ago, and it took me a long time to work through. But when I went back to make amends, I realized by the response immediately of the other person, the reaction of the other person, that I probably, my speech was off, but I couldn't figure out what it was. So I tried to reframe, and that was fine. That worked. But the second time I got into another argument, and somehow I caught that I was saying, "You said," and I went, bingo. For the first time, I understood how another person would immediately go into defense or offense when someone says, "You said," because we're either going to be in threat or we're going to be in hostility. And, like, it finally went down and sunk to my belly button. So I wanted to share that. I'm going to be paying a special attention when I'm in a tense or uncomfortable situation to be paying attention to what I'm saying rather than give so much attention to the other. So thank you very much.
You're welcome and deserving. Thank you for that input. I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. And I'll turn on the microphone for and welcome Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tim. Thanks, Dr. Tim. I appreciate you.
You're welcome and deserving, and have a wonderful show.
Thanks. So welcome, everybody, to Mind Shifters Radio. And today is Thursday, March the 7th, 2024. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. And we would love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. And we'll give Michael a moment to dial in and go to the website, whyagain.org, and check out all the new links. If you find something that's not working, please let us know. And hold on a second. I am putting a package out here. I see the mailman coming. Running behind. All right. That is my apologies for that interruption. And so go to whyagain.org and look around. I've added some new postings, some new things to look at. If you go under schedules, you'll see there under live events that Michael has an event planned down in Sarasota, Florida, May the 3rd through the 5th. And the flyer is on there, so you can get that information. And if you're close to there or traveling through there, make a point of being part of that. Two of them are free on Friday evening and on Sunday. He's going to be doing Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And on Sunday, the Codependence to Interdependence. And on Saturday, he's going to be doing an all-day Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing workshop. So if you're in that area, participate in that. And he hasn't dialed in quite yet. I'll give him just a minute. And hi, Yinka, in the chat room. And I sent you an email. I hope you got it, that we had addressed your question yesterday on the show. And I sent you a link to yesterday, to the second hour, so you could listen to what Michael had to offer for. You had asked a question about ADHD and how to do work, what worksheets to do with a person. And so he addressed that if you want to check that out. And I've got Podbean going live right now as well. So multitasking, we were talking about that this morning. It's challenging. Sometimes you think you do pretty good multitasking and you don't really. But anyway, so we've got both of those going. And if you're new to the show, I see some new numbers on the switchboard, that we have a section on the website under Kaboris and Enlightenment Study. And I have put the second hour since we started doing that all in one place, so you can go back and pick those up if you have missed any of them. We started doing the Enlightenment back on January the 15th, and here it is, March the 7th. Time just really flies. Anyway, Michael has now joined us, so I'm going to say welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart, and welcome, everybody. Delighted and honored that you're here. And that the conversation comes up to the next level as we delve deeper and deeper into looking at this amazing Aramaic understanding and instruction set. You know, it's interesting that out of the Aramaic, literally thousands of religions have come. At least five of the world's major religions. Or when I say thousands, or thousands of sects of different religions have come. You know, the New Testament, Old Testament scholars or wisdom keepers were Aramaic. The Quran was written in Aramaic. The Zoroastrian scriptures were written in Aramaic. It's suspected that the Buddha spoke Aramaic. It's a language that conveys things that, in my awareness, no other language can convey. And so there are many things that need to be developed in the mind for the mind to be able to even start to conceive of what's being said in that language. And one of the things we've been talking about are these two filters, one in the frontal lobes of the brain called Rachma, over intentions, one over the back of the brain, perception, that keeps the mind keyed to love and opens a gateway for love to enter our human form. So when they said Rachma and Kubha, the two words that represent those filters or gateways, when they said perfect love casts out fear, they were saying if these filters are set in your mind, then your mind cannot generate a construct based in fear. This can't happen. Like, you're free of it. And that becomes one of the most basic objectives of this work. Sadly, what's happened in most other cases is that people have taken the words of that language, translated it into the level of understanding of their own minds, and made up religions, or so-called religions. You know, we have, what, 32,000-plus sects now of so-called Christianity? And what's the most basic principle that has to happen for one to become a Christian? Well, or a true Muslim, or a true Buddhist, or a true Hindu. What has to happen? The mind that started out, you know, hold a newborn child, tap into the essence of the child, and you find love there. You'll notice most people look at life through hostility and fear. Those filters are what are active in them. So one has to be converted, and that's what we're looking to do this. We're looking to convert y'all, and we're looking to be converted. Not to a religion, though. Conversion is about converting back to a love-based mind, to a mind that literally is fueled by the active presence of love. And then one can enter into what's truly called prayer. Now, you'll notice that we live in a culture, this Greek-oriented culture, is kind of like, well, you know, prayer is putting your order into the cosmic gift catalog. Order the Creator around. Tell the Creator what the Creator should be doing for you today. When the word in Aramaic actually means to set a trap for love, for God. And you recognize the Creator is love. The word prayer in Aramaic, and you look back and they were pretty confused about it because they asked Yeshua, you know, tell us, teach us how to do it. They've been doing it all their lives, they thought, but obviously they must have recognized they weren't because they said, teach us how to do it. What does it mean to set a trap for God? Well, an analogy is the easiest way to understand. I have an antenna on the roof. If the antenna is properly aligned and oriented, it is a trap. It captures the signal from channel 4 or channel 2 or whatever it is, and I get to get a picture and sound. It captures that signal, feeds it into my TV, and that reflects as a picture into my room. So prayer in Aramaic is to be oriented and aligned, and that's what the instruction set is in what was called the Lord's Prayer. It's not a prayer at all, but it's a set of instructions for how to align and orient yourself so that the energy field in which you live, move, and have your being, you capture. You're a trap for it. And then you reflect it into the world. And what is that energy? It is the active presence of love. So another Aramaic symbol, not normal to Western thought, is kudsha. Or toward the bottom, second last paragraph on page 35, by the way. And that is the Aramaic ancestry in, to the Hebrew word kosher. And kosher means proper as delineated by the five books of Moses. Kudsha is a little broader, and it means proper as determined by interacting with the presence of love and bringing that expression of love into the world. And the English mind would call that functioning according to the will of God. And this specifically applies to man. So what are the rules? What are the laws? Remembering again that the Aramaic word law means how it works. What are the laws by which you become the space in which the active presence of love shows up and you are then directed by that presence of love? Because that's what was intended for us as humans. And then two Aramaic words, kata, K-H-A-T-A, and bisha, are rendered as sin and evil, respectively. However, the concepts cued by these words in the language of Yeshua are not normal to Western thought. Pardon me, each is an archery term. Sin, or kata, representing missing the target. So you're in the archery range, and you fire at the bullseye, and you miss the bullseye, and the scorekeeper yells, sin, you're off the mark. That's all the word means. If you fire at the target, and you miss the target altogether, then evil is the response, off target, totally and completely, where the arrow missed, where it went when it missed the target. Thus, in Aramaic, these words appear as not right, as opposed to the normal meaning of positive wrongs. Increasingly, neural research, research into the mechanics of the mind, appears to indicate the fact that the human mind cannot utilize a right-wrong judgment approach. Apparently, the mind must follow at any given moment a right, not right, or a wrong, not wrong evaluation system. That the mind's scanning system may be set to pick up what is right or to pick up what is wrong, but it cannot be set both ways at the same instant. So if one is, you know, brainwashed in wrong, 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 you'll listen, and most of the language, even when heading for a wonderful target, most of the language is about what's wrong. You know, someone goes through an abusive relationship and they come out of that relationship, and if they have this mindset that we're talking about here, they'll say, yes, I'm ready to go into a new relationship, and here's what I want. I don't want someone who's going to abuse me again. I don't want someone who'll ever yell at me. I don't want someone who'll ever steal my money. I don't want someone who... And the mind is set for what's wrong. And when our words follow a path, because we're creators and our words are literal frequencies that create cymatic effects in our physiology, that is, organize the state of our physiology, then our words become pretty important. You listen to Yeshua in the Aramaic, and he says, words hold the power of life and death. So the Aramaic limitation of sin and evil to not rights appear to reflect this newly discovered facet of the mind's mechanics. Off the mark, not right, rather than, oh, you're wrong. The person who's repeatedly told, and rather than being properly taught, and it's interesting in the word, in the Aramaic language, the word discipline comes from the word disciple, which means properly taught. If one is properly taught, then rather than focusing on what's not right, one is taught to language what is on target, what is correct. One of the things our granddaughter, who's now 5, has really, oh, how long has that been? Maybe the last 4 or 5 months, Jeannie, that Aria has been really clear about when either Jeannie or I or she languages something that is other than what we really want, she'll say, cancel that thought. And she's shared with us, she's tried to introduce that idea at school, and the kids won't do it. So she says, well, when they say something like that, I just cancel it for them. So when we get the mind to its on-track state, and rather than positive wrongs, it's right, or, well, that's not right, but here's the replacement, what we're going to language about. Gee, your behavior, Aria, there was really not very acceptable. And here's what we want to do in the future. Here's how we treat each other. Here's how we behave when we fall out of line with the truth of what we want. And as all of the language is about the constructive aspect of life, not ignoring the destructive, but if the destructive comes along, being conscious, aware of it, and realizing that it's simply an energy to be removed, not an energy to be condemned, not an energy to be condemned over. Listen, how many parents, you watch how many parents, and the child does something that's quote-unquote in their minds wrong, and the conversation becomes about what's wrong with you and the condemnation, and now you're a positive, positive, not meaning positive, negative, but affirmative sinner. And how crazy is all of that when you realize how the mind works? So when you understand the mind's mechanics, you want to make sure that it's working with right, not right, if there's a not right, and then a correction. So the limited material from the Kabbalists is felt to be of sufficient quantity to add materially to the understandings available in standard texts, particularly in relation to mind development and the mind maintenance instructions of Yeshua of Nazareth. The versing is in conformity with the King James Version, We sincerely hope and pray that these few lines hereafter presented will provide a wider understanding of and respect of the most complete truth ever made known on earth, the teachings of Yeshua of Nazareth. For the inevitable errors in the text, we sincerely apologize. And it's signed by the Yonan Codex Foundation, 1974, the Kaboris Foundation, 2004, and Heartland Aramaic Mission, 1988 and 2014. And so that kind of gives us a basis of where we're going. And Miss Jeannie, before I step up to the next piece of the puzzle, is there anybody in the phone queue with a hand up? Anybody out there that has a thought for us? If you're on one of those stations where we can't see you, our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And if you call that number, you'll be listening to the show directly. And then if you have a question, just push one, and we'll have a conversation. So, Ms. Jean, do we have anybody out there in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
It is all quiet on the home front.
Okay. Some of those who are listening, I know, have a copy of this text that is not numbered in the same way that this one is. And that would be if you've got it in a copy, if you've done Laws of Living, you've got it in a copy of your Laws of Living book. So we're going to move now to the space. If you look, there's a printed photograph of the Kaboris, of the colophon. So we're going to move in the printed text, it's page 37, or the bound text. In the Laws of Living text, I'm actually not sure what page it is on. I don't have a copy of that here. But we're going to talk about the colophon. And so one of the more intriguing attributes of the Kaboris Codex is the colophon. A colophon is a tailpiece in old books, often ornamental, giving information on now placed in the, what, you know, normally today would be placed in the title page of a book, such as the author and the content and such. The word colophon derives from the late Latin term borrowed from the Greek colophon, meaning submit. We now call this page the preface or introduction. The colophon often contained a warning or foreboding to anyone who might think about altering the text to which it was attached. In the ancient scriptures, this type of colophonic material appears in the warnings at the beginning and end of the books of Revelation and so forth. The colophon to the Kaboris Codex contains 26 discernible lines and two or three indiscernible lines. And this is working from enhanced photography. I had the privilege of having that manuscript in my possession for about a year, in which time I went from one side of the country to the other, as we were working with getting the text, high-resolution digital images made of the text. So I got to sleep with it under my bed for just about every night for a year. It was pretty cool. So normally a colophon would contain information about a scribe, the editor of a document, indications pointing to possible locations of the document's origins. Sometimes the colophon will contain blessings or quote-unquote cursings, depending on the importance of the document to the scribe and their community. So if you've got the printed text on page 38, you'll see that page. And it's pretty amazing. If you don't have the text or you want to take a look at the whole text of the Kaboris, we do have, they're not the high-resolution images, but on our website, if you go to whyagain.org/Kaboris, K-H-A-B-U-R-I-S, you'll be able to access all 515 pages of the text. Be able to look at them, and it's an exercise to just be with the energy that comes off of the text. I know when I was traveling, you know, several times I was invited to present it to a group of people, and when you would open the text, people would gasp. They would feel the energy of that book. It was pretty cool. And what we know is, again, it goes back to the 10th century, the physical manuscript called the Kaboris. We've had it carbon dated twice at the University of Arizona. kind of a primo carbon dating facility. And they've dated it twice at 1000 AD plus or minus 50 years. So that's the age of the physical vellum on which it's written. The introduction page to the manuscript tells us that it is a second century copy, or pardon me, a copy of a second century text. So it would make it a copy of the oldest known New Testament in Aramaic. And so page 39, we're going to look at some selected verses from Matthew. And the introduction here affirms that this is translated directly into English from the ancient Aramaic. It's interesting, there are some so-called scholars out there who say, oh, well, you know, the Aramaic texts were actually translated from the Greek. The Greeks, you know, of course, the Greeks wrote it down first. We all know that any Semitic person we know would write it down themselves. They'd hand it to the Greeks and let the Greeks write it. And then they'd copy it back into their own language. That would be a logical thing to do, right? Right, sure. Okay. So let's start looking at chapter 4 from 1 to 10. And what you'll see is that the key words are left in Aramaic in brackets. And then in the back of the text, there is a second century dictionary, or first century. There were 25 of the world's top Aramaists back in the 70s that, pardon me, did this translation work. And one of the main focuses of the work they did was to establish the first century, as well as they could, the first century meanings of the words. So the first, then Yeshua was drawn from, and it word M-I-N in Aramaic, which is a preposition meaning from or out of. So Yeshua was drawn from Ruka de Kudsha into an unprotected state. So what, when we talk about Ruka de Kudsha, remember we're talking about this feminine elemental force that undoes the effects of our errors and teaches us the truth. It's our guidance system. So what's being said is Yeshua was guided to go into what has been translated as an unprotected state. That is, if we look in the dictionary, it's an area outside of the protection of the city walls. Remember we talked about the camel going through the eye of the needle. And it isn't about a sewing needle. There was a gate. They were inhospitable people, but they were in dangerous territory. So at night they closed the city gates. But there was always one small gate through which a man could pass, and a camel could be kind of forced through. But you couldn't have a load of weapons on it and take it into the city and attack the city. You'd have to get the camel down on its knees, and you'd have to unload it, and you'd have to kind of guide it through the gate. So what is being spoken of here is that he's moved outside of the city walls, and that this can also refer to a condition where one is without mental or emotional protection. So I think we could render that a vulnerable state, or what would be his stress from unrighteousness. And so, you know, he's guided to move into this vulnerable state. And then the term unrighteousness, A-K-H-I-L-K, A-K-H, and I'm flipping back into the dictionary as we speak. A little bit of flipping back and forth here. tapping into or stepping into a state where there's not protection available, or there may be those around who are not particularly supportive. And so he's drawn into, and you know, the way the Greeks translated it is the wilderness. So in essence, what they're speaking of here is that he's going to go into a state where he's ready to do some work. He's ready to open his field and do some inner work. And it's what it says is he fasted for 40 days and 40 nights. And I can relate to that very well from a very recent experience. Several days ago, I had a healing crisis open up for me physiologically. And there was a spot, one of the places I've worked for many years. I've had a pretty tough birth experience as a kid, as a newborn, to the point where they told my father that I wasn't going to make it through the night. You better get down to the hospital if he wanted to see me alive at all. And so the other night I had a spot open up in my cranium that was just really, really intense. And moving into it, did some work on it, and you know, let go of food, did some fasting, and went into a real detox, which meant a state of physiological discomfort. Sinuses draining. One of the things I had happened to me as a kid was, I can remember so many times just screaming in pain from ear infections. And so for about 24 hours in my right ear, I was putting in food-grade hydrogen peroxide to handle the detoxing in that ear of the infection that had opened up. So I assume from the symptoms that it was something right back to my early childhood. And then once that ear cleared up, my other ear started. So I spent the night putting peroxide drops in that ear and just had a general detoxification occur. And about the third day of it, Jeannie had made some dinner. I hadn't been eating very much, but Jeannie had made some dinner, and I was like, okay, I'm hungry. I'm ready to eat. And I was in this detox state, but about the fifth bite of food, it just totally shut down. That whole physical symptomatic release quit. And I expressed to Jeannie, I shouldn't have eaten. I should have just let this keep going. But whatever it was, 3 or 4 days was enough. I was ready for some relief from the symptoms of it. But that's just a step and a part of the healing process. And so what he offers, and so what moves when you open on that level is anything in you that doesn't belong in you. And so what are they saying happens to Yeshua after this 40 days and 40 nights? What they talk about is what came was temptation. What would temptation be? Well, anything that one has not dealt with within their own minds and bodies will start to move. And as they start to move, they will experience the energetic impact and the symptoms of release, which is exactly what I had going on for a period of about 3 days. So what we're hearing here is Yeshua basically is going into a detox. Tendency, what happens when you start to detox an old energetic pattern is that energetic pattern will tend to be used very readily to build the construct in your mind called perception. And the inclination to believe those perceptions based in hostility or fear can be pretty strong. And so it's spoken of as a force outside of him. And, you know, if you are the son of God, if you are the son of the creator, Allah, say to these stones to become bread. And Yeshua responds, you know, it is written that not by bread alone does man have a perfect life, kathia, but by every word, i.e., milta. If you go to the opening words in the book of John where we're told it says, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word became flesh. Not what it says in Aramaic. It says, in the beginning was the mind energy, and the mind energy became flesh. And so what he's realizing is his own carbon-based memory is trying to suck him in, but he's able to respond with the awareness that, no, it's Miltha, the mind energy that issues from the Creator that I choose to take as the words I follow. So I'm going to stay attuned to, even though my mind is detoxing with something based in hostility or fear, I'm going to stay attuned to the active presence of love in me and the mind energy that comes from that. And that energy of the detox, he makes a choice different than falling into what's moving in him. That is the quote-unquote, as the first paragraph book of unrighteousness, the energy that's less than love. He uses that. He consciously rides that wave through choice and will to move into a state of active love, to be this, a state of guidance from Ruka Dikutcha. So you see that it moves into this, and here renders it as holiness, into where the mind has the inclination in a healing crisis to draw us into a narrowed state. It's interesting, in Aramaic, the word heaven can be properly translated as expansion. The kingdom of expansion is within, where when the mind is detoxing old energies, dropping into the desert or the unconscious, then the tendency to be can be to drawn into trusting that. And what this is implying here in chapter 4 or 5 is that he uses that energy to carry him into a more whole state, being into a higher state of awareness instead of being lost in carbon-based memory, being lost in the perceptual mind. And so this temptress, this tempting force, says to him, if you are the son of God, cast your nafsha and nafshak. If we look at that, is the word that represents our human beingness. And so he's in a state where he's being invited, kind of, you know, like, give the Creator a little slap. Like, here, I'm going to fall, and you have to come and save me. You have to come and fix me. And so the quote here is about, you know, for it is written that the angels will have charge over you, and the hands they will take you, and your feet, they will not be touched by a stone. And Yeshua says, also it is written, to not put your Creator to the test. In other words, the idea is to trust the active presence of love in you rather than, and you know, if many humans have a power person dynamic where the authority in their lives is always testing them, whether it's a parental authority, an educator, it's like, you know, we're going to test you. And under stress, that can become a power person dynamic, and somebody's going to turn around and like, well, I'm going to test the Creator. Do I really trust the Creator, or am I going to test the Creator? Yeshua saying, I don't have any need here to test the Creator. I already know. And once again, it says this unrighteous state of mind carries him to a high mountain and points to him everything of the world and all the things the world's got to offer. So what's the ego mind doing here? What's Satan? Remember in Aramaic, Satan means the resister, one who misleads. What Yeshua is saying is what's most important in my life is to live in and as the active presence of love. And the mind says, but you could have power. You could have money. Look at all the things the world can offer you. And, you know, the ego mind says, all these things I'll give to you if you fall prostrate and worship me. In other words, the ego is saying, I want to run your life for you. I want to take over where you put your time, intelligence, money, and energy. And we're going to make sure that you get all the stuff you can get, as though that has value. And Yeshua responds, get out of me, Satan, again, the resister, one who misleads. I'm going to yield up the part of my mind. I'm going to forgive as to the part of my mind that wants me to draw me into a lower state in order to produce some sort of benefit. There's nothing I'm interested in having if I have to step out of a state, if I have to step out of my natural state as love to get it. And so he's telling the resistor in himself, and it's interesting as I'm speaking this, I'm feeling the sensation in my ear that I was just talking about that went through the detox several days ago. It's the first time I felt it since. So there must be another level of that getting ready to move for me personally. So thank you, everybody, for the vitalizing support. Just new level of energy moving for me. So Yeshua, when he's tempted, and tempted being there's some inclination to accept the world of hostility or fear in order to get an external result and yield up your connection to Rukka, yield up your connection to your source. And so Yeshua rejects that whole deceiver and repeats out of the scriptures, for it is written, you shall emulate or worship love. And that's it. That's what you're here to serve. So in essence, he's affirming that he's here to serve the presence of love in his life. He's not here to get stuff. He's not here to create false gods. And so that's the first set of passages. And as I said earlier, there are limited passages from the New Testament. And for me, that would be the lesson that would come out of that particular chapter, is to make sure that if you're going to follow guidance, that you're not following the guidance of the part of you that's in resistance. And how will you tell if the resistance is active in you? There'll be some form of hostility or fear attached to the perceptual constructs of your mind. And if that happens, there's where your forgiveness work is. It's like, no interest in living there at all. Thank you very much. And then the next step, and we'll go up to the top of page 40, is heads into the Beatitudes. This is one of my favorite sections of this whole text, to tap into the Aramaic Beatitudes. And so Matthew 5:1, when Yeshua saw the crowds, he ascended the mountain, and he was seated. His disciples drew near to him, kribo, the Aramaic word. So they're tapping in energetically to him. Now, when one is speaking about a Sermon on the Mount, ascending, we're not talking about a physical hill. We're talking about stepping into a higher state of mind, a higher state of awareness. And the general attitude, at least as I've seen it and as I experienced it myself before I started to understand the Aramaic, around the Beatitudes, that it's this really powerful and sweet and nice and wonderful philosophy. But actually, it is not a philosophy. It is a set of instructions for how to achieve a result that is achievable. So in Aramaic, Yeshua delivered simple, practical teachings, and the first word in each of the Beatitudes is Tuvehun, which is historically interpreted as a bestowed blessing. Big distinction here with the Aramaic. You know, it's like the Greek teachings are like, well, see, something is going to come along and bless you. But in Aramaic, actually, there's an element of earning a reward. There's an element of achieving a result that will be a reward to you. So each of the Beatitudes is an instruction set for how to achieve this reward. And what is the reward? Before each of the Beatitudes, the word is Tuvehun. It's a three-part word. And in essence, what it says is the Creator implanted in your mind neural structures which will guide you when they're active. If they are inactive, you who follow these instructions will come into conscious possession of and be able to use this latent guidance system. And that guidance system is designed to make available thoughts and actions that will increase your happiness and well-being. So in essence, what Yeshua was saying 2,000 years ago is, hey, everybody, you have in you a creator implanted neural structure that will guide you to your highest and best life. The guy down the block or your parent or the teacher or whatever told you, here's how you get to your highest and best life. Well, what you do is you just, you know, make sure you bully everybody out of the way and you become the king of the castle and you get all the money. Well, I've seen a lot of people in my 50-plus years of working with people that had a lot of money. But, you know, I never saw too many of them that were very happy about it. So what Yeshua is saying here is that there is in you a guidance system, but there's some things you're going to have to do to bring it out of its latent or unconscious state and bring it into a conscious state. Now, classically, the Greek translation, the first beatitude is, blessed are the poor in spirit, theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, you remember that in another passage, Yeshua talks about how you can deny him, but don't deny the spirit. Don't deny Ruach HaKodesh, the one that he's come to connect you to. So this is like one of the core pieces of his teaching. You have to engage in this guidance system that is put into you by the Creator. And here's the first beatitude that's telling you that what you want in regard to that guidance system is to be poor. It's like, duh. Hello, could you be much more, you know, like, that's at least 179 degrees out of phase with what he said. So the first step, and literally we're talking about, you know, remember that neural structures are what, when active, create perception. Perception is a construct of the mind, and it's meant to guide us. It's meant to be, as we determined earlier, the light, the guidance for your earthly life. And what you want to do is make sure that the guide is always keyed to light instead of hostility or fear, which is darkness. So instead of counseling people to be poor in spirit and therefore getting some reward afterward, boy, has that ever put a lot of money in people's pockets. What he's saying is, you who have, in Aramaic, it's meskeni, and the word would more properly be translated as home. You who have a home, most people's home is in their perceptual minds, the constructs of their minds. Yeshua was saying, no, that's not where you want your home to be. You want your home to be in the active forces from the Creator. You want to be attuned to the energy field in which you live, move, and have your being. You want that to be your home rather than the constructs of your mind. If your mind goes off track and your home is there, it's going to be really hard to correct. And, you know, we're taught in this culture that the mind is the king and the end-all and the be-all. You know, what did Descartes say? You know, Descartes put Descartes before the horse. He said, I think and therefore I am, as though thought was the prime level or the prime mover of the world. Thought is not the prime mover of the world. I be, remember when they said to the Creator, what's your name? I am. Is be, and from being comes thought. Now, what passes as thought in the mind is just recycled data from the past. We're looking to escape the recycled data from the past. We don't want your home to be in the fears, the hostilities, the goals, the wants, the desires of your mind. Because if it is, and there's error there, how are you going to correct your error? If you're living in it, if that's like, you know, if you're like the fish in water, if that's all you see, how are you going to find correction? But if your home is in the eternal forces from the Creator, then you know that thought is just, and perception is just a construct. It's meant to guide you, but you're coming from a place that keeps the guidance system on track, rather than the danger of getting lost in the forces of the mind. So this first beatitude, speaking about you who have a home in Rukha, the active forces from the Creator, for yours is an heavenly estate. And remember that in Aramaic, a proper translation of the words Kingdom of Heaven, two aspects to it. One, it can be properly translated as the community of love, and two, the kingdom of expansion. So that implies that if you're in the eternal forces rather than in your head as your base, then you are in this space of connected love and always in a state of expansion. And when you look at what we now have seen from the newest Webb telescope, the expansion's got a long way to go. We've got, you know, a tremendous space for growth as human beings to comprehend what this creation is really about, to move beyond our own meddling little worlds, to move into the space where we're capable of bringing through what's really possible. And that's not going to come from the mind. That's going to come from that state of being. And part of doing this work is you distinguish the difference. You know when an energy comes, you know when an inclination comes that is your higher guidance as opposed to the mind. And you live in that higher guidance rather than in the mind. And so the result of that is yours will be Malkuta Dishmea, a heavenly estate. You will live in a state of guidance and expansion. So that's the first beatitude, and we're down to about the last 10 minutes. So before I push any further beyond that, I'm just going to open the space and see, Miss Jeannie, if we've got anybody else out there with a hand up in the phone queue or anything having a chat room.
There's no hand up, but a question in the chat room. How do you transition from punishing to offering a way that you have explained to children or others when punishing is all that you know?
Well, that means that you have, well, in a very similar way, what we've been talking about with this text is when you go from Greek to Aramaic, there are certain words that have similar meanings. And then there are words, like several of the words we've talked about, that we haven't even put into English in the text. They're in Aramaic, which indicates that you have to acquire a new understanding. So my offering would be you're going to have to build some brain cells and develop a new understanding. And there's a dual process that you're going to have to engage in order to do that. One part of the process is going to be engaging in forgiveness. Remember that forgiveness in the context of the Aramaic language has nothing to do with I'm going to let you off the hook for what's happening inside of me. If I think you're to blame for what's happening inside of me, I'm now living in a lie in my mind. In order to actually develop a perceptual construct that tells me that you caused this in me, I have to dissociate from the real cause of what's happening in me, and I disable myself in the ability to change that. Forgiveness corrects that whole process, and I start undoing, put the word undoing or removal in place of forgiveness. So engaging in the removal process of everything based in hostility or fear, and then build the brain cells for a new way of expression, a new movement. So literally everything in this work, I mean, if you go back to day one, we've been doing this radio show now for, I think I heard Tim say the other day, 14 years, but I think we're actually in the 12th. Now I might be mistaken. Correct me if I'm in error. But if you go back to the first radio show 12 years ago and listened to every radio show since, and there have only been, you know, in the last X number of years, there have maybe been a total of 10 days where we haven't done a radio show. But if you went and listened to every show every day, 5 days a week for the last 12 years, I wouldn't address anything other than the question that was just asked. Everything would be related to how do I move from this state of being off the mark, to this state of being connected to an expanding awareness of myself as the presence of love, which will give me opportunities to forgive, to confront, to detoxify those things that might tempt me to fall into something that's less than love. I'm going to be given opportunities to utilize the tools, and I'm going to build new brain cells for how to move forward out of that state of love. I'm going to pay attention to, and I'm going to start changing my language. I'm going to, like, for instance, the thing I offered, you know, Aria, she says she's five, and she's offered kids at school this idea when they get into something negative of canceling a thought. She says, well, they just won't do it, so I cancel it for them. There are going to be a lot of thoughts to cancel if your life has been about hostility, fear, punishment, being motivated, being driven by fear, being driven by punishment, being, you know, controlled through fear. It's a like a mega major piece of work and transformation. So my offering would be engaging in that work is what it's going to require. And again, you could go back into the archives. We've got literally 12 years of archives.
Actually, and we hit 13 years. The 31st of January, we started our 14th year.
Well, thank you, Dr. Tim. Okay. Wow,
yeah,
I'm 2 years
started
behind,
January,
14.
January 31st, 2011.
Thank you, Dr. Tim, for saying that, because I've been saying 12 years now, probably for the last 2 years. I don't know. But anyway, okay, so we're at 14 years now. So every radio show you could listen to, and every radio show will answer that question. We'll give you another tool, another approach, another piece of work, another example, another interaction with someone who's in that same place doing, well, maybe not exactly the same details, but basically doing the same thing, maybe punishing themselves and coming out of that punishment, looking at their thought disorders. You know, sadly, what many people do is they use language to try to embody an experience that can only be embodied by direct experience, but they try to grab it through language. We're going to use language to describe a set of tools that, when used, will produce a result. The language itself won't produce a result, but the tools, when used, will produce the result. As I said earlier, we are literally looking to convert every mind, heart, and being on the planet. Not into a religion. We have no religion. There's no religion here to join. It doesn't exist. But we are here to offer the opportunity to remove the hostility and fear-based energetic patterns that are in anyone's mind. We're here to hold the space for that and to facilitate that and to build the brain cells for having a mind that prompts one through integrity and the presence of love. And then understanding the healing process, you know, to me, that first passage that we read about Yeshua in the desert, what's the desert? The desert is a code word for the unconscious. The desert wasn't about a hot, sandy place. You know, if we listen to the story of Yeshua or of the Jews back, you know, several thousand years ago, we're told they got lost in this hot 35-square-mile sandy place for 40 years. Which is pretty ridiculous when you think about a group of people who understand astronomy pretty well. How could that happen? Not even possible. But the desert is a code word for the unconscious. And what did they say had to happen to get out of the desert? They said the old generation had to die off. The root of the word generation is genari. It means cause. The causes in mind, based in hostility, have to go. And the engagement in the energetic patterns through language and thought have to move toward the active presence of love. When that occurs, a shift takes place. And that's what this work is about. So delighted and honored that you're here, and we'll step into the next level of the Beatitudes tomorrow. Thanks for joining us. Some blessings. Bye-bye.